Good morning. You stuck it out to the last. I know a few folks had to leave this morning right after breakfast, and we understand that with schedules and drive time and so on, but so thrilled that so many of you were able to stay until the last session together. And Shelley and I just want to say a huge thank you for inviting us to be with you this week. We have enjoyed it so much. We've been blessed in so many different ways by it. Something fall over there that... Okay, all right, he's got it handled. All right, just wanted to be sure everybody was okay. All righty. We're going to close on a fun note talking about trauma. healthy pastoring through emotional and spiritual trauma. We're going to deal both with the pastoral trauma, that is the trauma that we sometimes experience, as well as helping people through their episodes of trauma as well. One last reminder, you can get all of the notes for this and all of my previous sessions by scanning that QR code or by going directly to that link. One of the books that I put on the screen yesterday, one of the newer books I put on the screen yesterday, was The Great Dechurching. If you are looking for something to read, first of all, read my books. After that, I highly, highly, highly recommend The Great Dechurching, one of the most important books for pastors and leaders that has been written in the last 5 to 6 years. It is a very pointed assessment about where we are, especially in the American church today, plus some solutions, some answers to where we can be going next. The key premise to the book is this statement. We are currently experiencing the largest and fastest religious shift in U.S. history. This is statistically proven to be so. And let me walk you through what some of that is. According to the book, before now, the largest religious shift in church attendance in the U.S. occurred during a 25-year period after the Civil War. From 1870 to 1895, church attendance more than doubled as people resumed their post-war lives. That religious shift pales in comparison to what we're seeing today. Today, quote, more people have left the church in the last 25 years than all the new people who became Christians from the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, and all Billy Graham crusades combined. The pandemic is often to blame for this shift, but in fact, the pandemic did not cause the shift. The pandemic amplified and accelerated it. It did in 2 years what normally would have taken a decade to happen, but it didn't cause anything. It just shone a bright light on what was already happening. If you were missing the reality of this shift before pandemic, it's impossible to miss it after the pandemic. Now, when we talk about dechurching, here's how they defined it in their book. They say, we defined a dechurched person as someone who used to go to church at least once per month, but now goes less than once a year. So we're not talking, you know, just they say it or whatever, but it's by actual attendance. And they say about 40 million adults in America today used to go to church but no longer do, which accounts for about 16% of the adult population. And the baby boomers are dechurching in the largest numbers. Neither the political left or the political right is immune to this. So whichever side you're on, pointing fingers at the other side, stop it. Among evangelicals, it says, there is more danger of dechurching on the right than on the left. So on the right, there is more lack of attendance. One of the things that we've discovered has been that a lot of people who still consider this, call themselves Christian or even call themselves evangelical or even identify by a denominational title still have stopped going to church and are no longer attending. And a lot of people have now used evangelical as more a political identifier than a religious identifier. And so they're trying to sort out what that means in the language that people use. Here's another interesting point. Americans who make less money are more likely to dechurch than those who make more. We thought it was the opposite, right? People get money, they get relaxed, they don't worry about it. It turns out people who make less money are actually dechurching faster than people who make more money, which is really fascinating. Political extremism. There are those who have become disenfranchised with the church because it is too synchronized with right-wing politics. And there are almost as many who have become disenfranchised with the church because it's not synchronized enough with right-wing politics. Right? Whichever one you do, you're going to have somebody shooting at you. And they say the greatest source of pastoral anxiety in their study is the disconnect between pastors and the congregation based on political views. It's the most common stress point for pastors today. So all of that just gives you some idea of the kind of situation that we're in right now. We live in a very traumatic time with the pace of change faster than anything I've ever seen in my lifetime. The current pace of change is right now faster than our ability to adapt. Did I do it or not? No, okay, well, there's an illustration. I couldn't remember if I put it on the slides or not. Before the Industrial Revolution, the pace of change looked something like this. While generations came along something like this. So you could go 5 or 6 generations and everybody in every generation, they would see virtually no generational shift. You could go 5 or 6 generations and a farmer would be using, not only were they a farmer like their great, 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 great grandfather, but they were on the same land as their great, 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 great grandfather and often using exactly the same tools as their great, 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 great grandfather. Like they changed out the wooden handle and that was all. And the same way in the kitchen with moms to daughters and so on. And so then every once in a while you'd have something that would come along like the rise of Christianity or like the Renaissance and something would shift real quick, but then it would settle into a new normal and you could go 6, 7, 8 generations with almost no change at all. And we have the mental and emotional capacity for that slow pace of change. Now the pace of change and generations are flipped. Instead of the pace of change being like this and generations being like this, now what you've got is the pace of change is like this and the generations are about like this. And so a change that used to take 6 or 7 generations to occur, we now have 6 or 7 of those changes within a generational lifetime. Right? I have an iPhone. In October, they stopped updates for the iPhone X, which came out 7 years ago, which means the most advanced tool on the planet 7 years ago became obsolete in October. That's the pace of change. And that causes challenges to us in trying to pastor and trying to manage our own lives when things are changing at that pace. And what it does is it causes some trauma for a lot of folks. And let's talk about this and how to do some trauma recovery. As we are trying to recover from constant changes and constant challenges because of those changes, and the disconnect that we often feel between ourselves and our congregation, as it says, the most common one is political, but there are all kinds of other ones as well. There are some things that we need to understand, and so let me walk you through some tools. Tool number one for me is always this: don't try to go back to what was. I was going to say we're not time travelers. That's not true. We are time travelers. We're just all moving in the same direction and at the same pace through time. But you can't go back. There is no going back. I know when we look at stats like this, we think, oh, if only we could go back to the good old days. And if you look back to the good old days and you're really honest about it, you're going to discover they weren't really quite as good as you remember. And they certainly weren't as good for everybody as they might have been for you. And so there's no good old days, there's just days. And there's today. And so don't try to go back to what was. This idea, I talked to somebody yesterday about this, and they brought it up, and they said the discouragement that they feel sometimes when they talk to other pastors, especially post-COVID, if there's been some drop after that, so many pastors who all, their entire focus is, let's just get back to the way it was. We can't move in that direction. It isn't possible. So don't try to go back to what was. That would just cause further confusion and further trauma. So what do we do? Build on what you're learning. build on what you're learning. My dad taught me this. Whenever I would go through some difficult circumstance and I was whining about it, his response would always be, okay, yeah, but what are you learning from it? Really? Can't I just whine this time? Whine all you want, but I want to know what you're learning while you're whining. It was always that way. So his point was this. If you go through pain and you don't learn something from it, then all you get is the pain. But if I'm going to go through a traumatic circumstance, if we're going to face difficulties, and we do and we will, then if I'm going to go through a difficulty, I want to learn as much as I can from it. I want to take as much out of the pain as it takes out of me. And the only way I can take as much from the pain as it takes out of me is if I learn everything I can from it. Pain is like an accelerated learning course. The 2 years of pandemic, lockdown, whatever we're calling it these days, I don't know. If we will look back at that properly through the right lens, it can be an accelerated learning experience about how to deal with trauma, how to deal with change, how to deal with conflict resolution. Instead of just complaining about it, look at it and go, what can we learn from that? And every trauma as we have going forward, let's use it as a learning opportunity. It doesn't mean you won't be sad. It doesn't mean you don't need to recover. It doesn't mean it's easy. It just means I'm going to take something out of it in addition to what it's taking out of me. All right, build on what you're learning. And then thirdly, define your current reality. When you're going through a difficult time, it is a natural human response to want to look back and wish it was the way it used to be. So we've got to say, it will never be what it was. I now have to build on what I'm learning through this difficulty. And then the next step to that is define your current reality. I mentioned it yesterday. People say the first job of a leader is to define reality. The first job of the leader is to define reality. That's what the Apollo 13 table illustration was about, right? It's the best picture I know of defining the current reality. Everything that's on this table is everything on Apollo 13. That's their reality. On the ground, they can't say, we've got everything here. We just need 1 inch of duct tape to add to it. But that's not their current reality. Don't tell me how to fix it using duct tape that they don't have. Right? Define your current reality. The first job of the leader. Where are we actually now? What are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? What are the positives? What are the negatives? What are we dealing with? Don't wish it away. It is not a lack of faith to define your current reality. Jesus asked people to define their current reality. He asked one person, do you want to get well? Define for me your current reality. Do you want this? Right? Jesus never denied the current reality of sinfulness or of sickness or of pain. He never denied the reality because that's what the redemption of Christ can step into. Define your current reality. So those are the first three places to begin in thinking about that. All right. Now, it's important for us to understand, if you're wondering about why is he even talking about trauma today? We're pastors and we're serving churches and so on. Why are we even talking about trauma? And it's because God cares about our minds, not just our spirits. This is really important for us to understand because I have had some pushback on this. What are you talking about, you know, emotional health for? What are you talking about, you know, all this kind of stuff for? And you're bringing in psychological terms and everything else. Let's just deal with the spirit. No, God cares about our minds, not just our spirits. And I've got scriptural proof for that. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, Romans 12:2 tells us, but be transformed by the renewing of your spirit. Mind. And just so you know, the Greek word for mind means mind. By the renewing of your mind, then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And we know that's not the only place in Scripture where God says that our mind matters. Our minds need to be renewed. And a part of trauma recovery is the transforming and renewing of our minds in addition to the transforming and renewing of our spirits. So with the pace of change that we have right now, with all of the the trauma that's around us and so many people are dealing with. Here's an important pastoral rule of thumb, and I think it's especially important for us as small church leaders, for those of us who are. A good pastoral rule of thumb is this: assume that everyone is experiencing some level of trauma and recovery. They're not, but if you start with that assumption, then you're more likely to not tread on people in ways that will be harmful. If you deal with someone as though they're recovering from trauma and they're not, no harm done. But if you deal with someone as though they're not dealing with trauma and they are, harm done. So if we, and at this point, it's a flip of the coin whether or not you'll be right. Recent, very conservative statistics say that right around 50% of adults are dealing with some form of trauma. And if you deal with trauma recovery, it's 75 to 80%. Of people are either in trauma right now or are dealing with recovery from past trauma. Because we live in a broken world where bad things happen. There's this thing called sin. I don't know if you noticed it in any of the songs. That damages us, that hurts us, that breaks our relationship with God and with each other, and this causes a constant wave of trauma. And so a big part of our calling as ministers of the gospel is to step into traumatic spaces. Because we're stepping into traumatic spaces, because that's what peacemakers do, we will also experience some of the reverberations of that trauma into our own minds, bodies, and spirits. And so we need to be sure that we are in a place where we receive trauma recovery as well. Do you realize that pastors are maybe the only trauma specialists, the only helping people, the only professionals who are trained to do service for other people who are not required to get further training themselves on a constant basis, unless in some denominations you do have that, and I'm grateful for that. But for a whole lot of us, we get trained, we go into it, and we're not required at any point to check in. Like psychologists, they got to have a psychologist. People who are frontline workers, they are required to go and see mental health specialists after traumatic events. And for most of us, we are not required to do that at all, and we're suffering because of that. And so when we're trying to step into traumatic spaces to help people, and we experience a subsequent trauma ourselves because of that, because of our sensitive nature, because of our caring nature, we then need to be able to find healing for that ourselves. So start with the idea, assume that people are in a place of trauma and recovery. It will benefit you more often than you'll be wrong, right? So what happens when people are in trauma? When we were in the middle of a pandemic, and there was all, if you remember, it was such a lovely time, especially in that, you know, summer of 2020, where it seemed like just about every week there was some headline that any other year would have been the headline for the entire year. Like it was just one thing after another kept hitting us. And during that time, it was so much people were trying to figure it out. I actually remember that I've got a friend named Lori Andrews. And Lori Andrews actually is a pastor's wife and a PhD in education with an emphasis in trauma and psychology. She actually heads up the entire counseling department for the Hawthorne school system. And if anybody knows the LA area, Hawthorne is about as rough as it gets. So she oversees the entire counseling system for students in some of the most drug-infested, gang-ridden areas of our country. And she oversees the entire counseling system for it. So I thought, and she's a pastor's wife. I thought, I need to talk to Lori. And I called her up. And I said, can you talk to me about trauma? What happens with all that we're experiencing? What's going on here in our trauma? She gave me so much stuff, but here's one thing she gave me that just stuck out and has really helped me. She said this: when people are in acute trauma, they can't hear explanations. So what do you mean by that? She said, when people go to trauma, like imagine, for instance, a car accident. And you have a car, and maybe you've had one yourself, but even in the movies, if there's a car accident or there's a bomb that explodes and something happens immediately, even in the movies, all of a sudden the sound starts to go dull and down, right? And it's not just because the person's ears were loud, but it's because, she says, During trauma, especially immediate trauma, like a car accident or the death of a loved one or a battle or something like that, there's actually a crystal inside our ears that expands and blocks out some of our hearing. That's just one of many things that happens. She says they put people in brain scans to study what happens in your brains during trauma. And in trauma, there's one part of our brain that shuts down and two parts of our brain that light up. When we're in trauma, the two parts of our brain that light up are action and emotion, and the part of our brain that shuts down is our logic centers. Why? Because when you're running away from the bear, it's no time to be thinking about philosophy. So in trauma, our logic centers go dark. She says you would see it it's almost literally gone. Like you can't process new thought. And everything is action and emotion. Why? It's get me out of here. And the brain doesn't distinguish very much between being chased by a bear or the death of a loved one or a divorce. Right? So the response is get me out of here, whether it's an accident that's coming our way in the middle of a battle. The army has figured this out. Armies have figured this out millennia ago. They didn't know about the brain functioning, but they did know that the soldier who's facing their first battle is not going to be able to think through logically what to do next, which is why they train them so hard. What do? They break them down and build them up. And what's the word they always say when you go into your first battle? Rely on your training, rely on your training. What do they want to do? They want to build muscle memory into the soldier so that when their logic centers shut down, their action and emotion will be channeled into the training they received to know what to do. Right? So here's what you've got. When you've got a traumatic situation, you've got a whole bunch of people who are highly emotionally charged, who just want out of here, and you can't explain that to them. Because when people are in trauma, they can't hear explanations. So I told her, I said, but here's the problem. Explaining stuff is what I'm good at. Explaining stuff is what I was trained to do. I said, so if they can't hear explanations, as a pastor, how am I supposed to help them when they're in a position where they can't hear the explanations that I've got? She said, what they need is familiarity and stability. Familiarity and stability. They need to do familiar things in familiar places with familiar people. One of the reasons that the lockdowns have been so divisive and were so traumatic was because during this time, when we were all concerned about health and so on and arguing about it and all of that, in a whole lot of places, you couldn't meet with familiar people to do familiar things anymore. And so remember 9/11, right? With the trauma of 9/11, every church in the country was filled that night. Why? Because people needed to go to a place where they knew they could worship, where they could be with others, where they could find comfort, right? The churches and the bars were both filled that night, right? For similar things, right? They need familiarity and stability. So she told me this. She said, we have had a generation or so, we talked about a lot of this last night with Desizing the Church, where with the church growth movement, all of the talk was about how do we bring change to the church. Anybody think we need more change? I think we're changed up, right? And we did. There were some churches that were stuck and that were, they weren't paying attention to the changes around them, and we need to pay attention to that. But she says, when you're in a time of trauma, what people don't need is more change. What people need is more stability. And so things like what we've been doing this week, where he brought out so many of the older songs and pepped them up a little bit. By the way, a bass drop on that first song. What was the song that he sang? Not great. What was it? A bass drop on All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name is about as good as it gets, as far as I'm concerned. That was amazing, right? Yes, he's just going along. It's just nice. It's the hymn, and then all of a sudden the bass hits Johnny, and just boom, oh, we're in now. It was great. That was sweet, right? So the familiar is part of what helps us overcoming trauma. So when you find people in traumatic situations, you want to help them with familiar scriptures and familiar songs and familiar places with trusting people. That's what they need during a time of trauma, and that's what you need during a time of trauma as well. So Let me walk you through something that I discovered a couple years ago and that I have run by multiple mental health professionals, and they tell me I'm onto something. Because I am not a mental health professional. I'm just passing the information along. 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross gave a gift to the world when she wrote a book called On Death and Dying. And if you've never heard her name, you know her work. Because if you've ever heard or have you ever said to somebody, you're in denial, that's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She came up with the understanding that when we go through trauma, we go through five distinct but overlapping stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Most of you have heard of this. So when a trauma hits us, the first thing we go is, oh no, that can't be, denial. Then we move into, oh no, that shouldn't be, anger. And then we move into, oh, maybe if I do this and do this and do this, I can fix it so that it won't be, bargaining. And then we go into, oh, I can't fix it. It is this. Oh no, depression. And then we go into, okay, what am I going to do now? Acceptance. My whole thing yesterday from, oh no, or, right, oh no, so what, now what? That's me going through those stages in my whole church growth process. It's exactly the same thing. All right, so we go through these stages, but what I've noticed is when we are going through a traumatic experience together, for a lot of people, in fact, this is what really happened in 2020, when we had that summer of 2020, when we had one trauma after another, after another, after another, right? We had so many of them. So we had the pandemic lockdowns, and then we're going to come back. No, we're not going to go back again. And then we had the killing of George Floyd, and we had the unrest in the streets. And then we had, one of the most enjoyable, presidential elections in our lifetime. And then even when the election was over, it still wasn't over, right? And then it was just one thing after another. And what happens is when you get trauma piled on trauma, piled on trauma, piled on trauma, what I noticed was this. A lot of people, instead of using these stages as a way to work towards health, they subconsciously picked one of these stages and said, I'm just staying here. So let's take a look at this, and let's do it alphabetically. Some people are acceptors. When they're going through trauma, they're just accepting of it, and they just go, yeah, it is what it is, right? If you know somebody who's going through trauma and their entire response seems to be lighthearted, they just seem to be okay, and then all of a sudden they're gone, or they melted down, or they left their wife, or something, or all of a sudden they had it. It's like, what's going on here? Beware those who accept trauma too easily. They're usually the volcano that isn't willing to let release any of that energy. But when it does release, it's going to damage a whole lot of people. We can do that as well. We don't want people to see us in trauma. We don't want to see people to see how much we're hurt. And so we just put a fresh face on it. But be careful about that. People who seem to be too accepting of trauma on a continual basis are usually about to explode at some point and really hurt people. You can't just accept all of it. Secondly, you've got the anger people. These are the people who are like, man, if you're not angry right now, you are not paying attention. Have you noticed there are a few of those around us now? There's a lot of anger right now. Where is that coming from? I think it's because of compounded trauma. They get to the point where I'm not working through anger anymore. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to sit right here and you're going to feel it. Right? What I've discovered is that kind of anger is usually fear-based. It's easier to be angry than to admit you're afraid. So if you see someone who's angry, don't push back at the anger. Discover the underlying fear and see if you can allay the underlying fear. That will usually settle down the anger. Then you got people who land in the third one, in bargaining. These are the fixers. These are the ones who are always going to figure a way out of it, even if there isn't a way out of it, and not even admitting there's really a problem, they're going to try to fix everything. These are sometimes your best church volunteers. Have you ever had a great church volunteer who's there forever, is there all the time, and then all of a sudden they just leave and they quit, and you can't figure out why? I thought everything was great. If you've got people who are really hyper-volunteering and are almost never gone, one, appreciate them. Two, make them take breaks. I have gone to our most consistent volunteers and asked them, when was the last time you had a Sunday off? Oh, I don't take Sundays off. I just love it. But even when you have a vacation, yeah, I still come on vacation and I still teach the class on vacation, or I still set up chairs on vacation. I tell them, no, you're taking the next 2 weeks off. Why? Sometimes they're even mad at me. I tell them, I'd rather lose you for 2 weeks than lose you for good. You got to help people. You got to help the fixers manage their schedules. Third, you got those who are in denial on everything, right? There's a whole bunch of this around now. Everybody's lying. I don't trust anybody. I don't trust any doctors. I don't trust any preachers. I don't trust any teachers. I don't trust academics. I don't trust anybody. Except this one guy on YouTube. I trust him. Let me send you the video. He's awesome. This is a trauma response. I don't trust anybody anymore, what anybody says ever. That's a trauma response because they've had trust broken so many times that they've just decided it's easier not to trust anybody. There's a reason why the Bible constantly tells us to trust in the Lord with all your heart and don't lean on your own understanding. And all your ways acknowledge him. He'll direct your path. You start with the trust of the Lord. And then as we talked about last night, be trustworthy people ourselves. And then the fourth one is, or the last one there in that group is depression. They have said for years that people have a fight, flight, or freeze response to trauma. And they would say for years that you have a fight or flight response to trauma. And for years, I would hear that and go, I don't know which one of those I am. I don't feel like I'm either one. And then about 20 years ago, they said, actually, it's fight, flight, or freeze. And when they said that, I went, oh, they finally found me. I'm not a fighter, but I'm not going to run from the fight either. But I freeze. I'm deer in the headlights. That's my response to trauma is to freeze in place. I'm immobilized. But while I'm immobilized, my brain is working. I'm trying to figure it out. Where's the thing? Well, how do I do this? What's the best way to do this? And then after I finally let the trauma settle a little bit, then I jump into fixer mode and I come and I tell you how to fix all of your traumatic problems. That's what I'm doing right now. So why am I telling you that? Here's why I'm telling you that. It's really important for all of us to understand. First of all, we need to address the underlying fear, not the symptomatic behavior. That's what I told you about with the anger part, especially. But here's why I'm telling you about my trauma and how I respond. Recognize your own trauma first. As I've just described those five stages, you probably know of somebody who defaults to at least one of those stages on a regular basis. I saw some of you looking at each other going, oh, that's so-and-so, isn't it? Yeah, that is. Yeah, we know. Oh, now I understand why so-and-so responds the way they do, because they're one of the, oh, I get it. And as servers and leaders and pastors and so on, it's easy to look at others that way. But don't start there. Look at your own self and go, which one do you tend to land on? Do you tend to be the one who's depressed and goes into yourself? Are you the one? I'm going to guess that this room is filled with a lot of fixers. We're going to help everybody else fix their trauma as a response to my trauma. We got to recognize it. Define your current reality. This is who I am. So I know that about myself. I know that when I'm facing trauma, when I'm exhausted, I freeze. I am immobilized. I'm deer in the headlights. But my brain is trying to figure out how to shift to fix mode. And as soon as I'm out of the immediate trauma, then I've got all kinds of answers, and I'm going to fix this, and I'm going to fix this. Because I know that about myself, I can now anticipate that, and I can regulate my own emotions. And I know where to seek help because I know what it is that I'm dealing with. So when I'm in trauma, what do? I seek familiar things with familiar people in familiar places. And there are places where I know I can go, where I can relax, where I can be among people who love me and who love Jesus, and we can just sit and we can share, and I can tell them anything and they're going to be okay with it. And I have these places that I can go so that I can get out of being immobilized and I can not go too much into fix everybody else's problem mode. Your default will be different, but you need to know what your default is. Recognize your own trauma first, and then don't let your trigger become your truth. We are all triggered by different things. And we need to understand this. Truth is tied to our value system, and our triggers are tied to our emotional system. They are separate things, but we often conflate them. So we'll often talk to somebody and they're constantly angry about such and such. And we think that must be the most important thing in the world to them. Not necessarily. It may just be the thing that's triggering their emotional system right now. And the things that's triggering their emotional system, while they're loud about it, it may not actually be the thing that is actually most important to them. And we're susceptible to that as well. Right? How many of us have gone through a difficult season? It's like, oh, I just want to leave church. I don't even care anymore. And if you give yourself just a little bit of time, you realize you actually do care and you do actually want to stay. You were emotionally triggered. Give yourself a little bit of time. That's why we use terms like, I don't know, sleep on it. Because it allows our emotional system to go down a little bit so that we can now be operating out of our value system. Don't let your trigger become your truth. Don't make big decisions while you are on an emotional high or on an emotional low. And don't judge someone else's value system by the fact that they're triggered by things, because the thing that triggers them may not be connected to their value system. It may just simply be connected to their emotional state. And we've got to, now that you at least know this and look for it, you'll be able to spot it. Don't let your trigger become your truth. They are not the same thing. We know this is true because the scripture tells us this. If you want a lesson on this, just read Romans 7 again. In Romans 7, Paul is arguing, or he is having an argument. His trigger is arguing with his values in Romans 7. Right? And then at the end of it, he says, finally, thanks be to God who delivers me through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself in my mind, oh, there's that one again. In my mind, I am a slave to God's law. That's my truth. But in my sinful nature, my trigger, I'm a slave to the law of sin. Read through Romans 7 again. It's almost comical where he's talking about, I want to do this thing. I know this is the thing. This is my truth. This is my value system. But I keep doing something I don't want to do. My trigger. Why do I keep doing the thing I don't want to do? My trigger. Right? He's having this argument between his emotional state and his value system. And God says, that's important enough for us to understand that I'm going to let Paul put that in the Bible. So we can read it later and we can go, oh, okay. So if you think, okay, that's fine for other people, but I'm mature, I'm not emotionally triggered, I know how to keep my emotions in check, I'm just going to live by my value system. Okay, you just keep going along thinking that you're more spiritual than the Apostle Paul. That's fine. Right? Romans 7 is written by maybe the most mature Christian who's ever lived, near the end of his life, at maybe his most mature spiritual point, writing the greatest work of Christian theology that's ever been written, the book of Romans. And in the middle of that, he has an emotional breakdown and goes, why do I keep doing stupid things? So you're not too mature for it, because Paul wasn't. So let's acknowledge it. And that's because when we acknowledge it, we can do something about it. So let's start to wrap this up. Where do we start to go with this? Here's what I've noticed. When times are normal, leaders inspire change. I mentioned this earlier. So for the last 40-some years, for virtually my entire time in pastoral ministry, I came into pastoral ministry in the early 1980s, and it was, quite frankly, 40 years of calm. Yeah, there were moments. Yeah, there were issues. No, nothing was perfect. But quite frankly, the biggest issue that pastors faced during the 80s, 90s, and 00s was, how do we get people motivated and start to care again? How do we get complacent churches to be passionate again? Anybody think lack of passion is our problem anymore? Right? Lack of passion was the problem in the 80s, 90s, and 00s. That's what every pastoral conference talked about. In addition to growth, it was, how do we get to growth and how do we get people passionate about it? Nobody's worried about lack of passion anymore. Okay, so when times are normal, leaders inspire change. For those seasons, let's bring change. Let's try to motivate them. Let's try to get them moving along. Let's try to get them to change a few things. That was appropriate for that season of relative stability. But that's not where we are anymore. Today, we're in a time that's disruptive. And when times are disruptive, leaders provide stability. So this is a shift that we need to understand, and that a whole lot of us have not paused enough to take the time to pay attention to. I think the band is going to come up. Have them come, guys, if you're coming up, you can close in a moment. When times are disruptive, leaders provide stability. Here's how it comes across in Philippians chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. Do not be anxious about anything, But in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your, minds in Christ Jesus. Those two verses alone are a study in trauma recovery that are extraordinary. Don't be anxious. Don't be anxious about anything. Don't let the trauma overwhelm you. It's okay, it's going to be fine. But in every situation, what do? Prayer and petition. Let's go to the God who loves us and knows us, the one who never changes, and ask him to help us. Do so with thanksgiving. In the time of trauma, yeah. You want to know one of the greatest ways to get out of a time of trauma is to recognize the things you have to be grateful for. Gratefulness is a great solution to trauma. With thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And what will happen? The peace of God, which transcends understanding. Transcends understanding. Yeah, because when you're in trauma, you can't hear the explanations. There's very little understanding going on. So in that place of low understanding, the peace of God overwhelms us in a way that's beyond our mind's ability to comprehend, because our minds, our logic centers have gone dark, and it's just, God, help me. Read the Psalms again. This is people in trauma crying out to God over and over again on one hand, and on the other hand, people in thanksgiving crying out to God over and over again, and all of it transcends understanding. It's not less than understanding, it's greater than understanding. And this will guard your heart, your emotional condition, and your mind through Christ Jesus. Amen. We are called to bless people this way. We are called to help people in trauma recovery, but we can only do that when we are healthy ourselves. And thanks be unto God, he has given us the way to get there through the redemption of his son, Jesus. We are called to be peacemakers, and we must be people of peace first, to be peacemakers for others. Thank you so much for all that you do to serve. Thank you for the congregations that you represent and that you serve. I pray that as you leave here and you go, that you will leave with some sense of recovery, some sense of rest, and some sense of peace from being together this week. Thank you.